Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. And now save 50% on the new Sleep Number limited edition smart bed. Plus free home delivery when you add a base. Ends Monday. Exclusively at a Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
Chapter 19 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 19, How We're Besieged, and I Thought of Birnam Wood. I believe the doctor saved us from dangerous wounds, if not from death, for as he threw himself flat, half a dozen arrows struck the roof of our shelter and fell pattering down amongst us as we lay. "Here, quick, pass these forward," the doctor whispered, and we managed to get the blacks' loads between us and the enemy, making of the packages a sort of breastwork which sheltered us while we hauled forward some pieces of stone, arrow after arrow reaching this extempore paraport, or coming over it to strike the roof and fall back. The natives with us understood our plans at once and eagerly helped, pushing great pieces of stone up to us, so that in about a quarter of an hour we were well protected, and the question came uppermost in my mind whether it was not time to retaliate with a charge of shot upon the cowardly assailants who had attacked us when we were so peacefully engaged. We had time, too, now to look around us, and lament that our force was so much weakened by the absence of Jimmy and Aroo, who had gone to fetch more water. "They will be killed," I said, and I saw Ti-hi smile, for he had evidently understood my meaning. He shook his head, too, and tried to make me understand, as I found out afterwards, that Aroo would take care of himself. But we left off in a state of the greatest confusion. Being then well sheltered, we contrived loopholes to watch for our enemies, and Ti-hi pointed out to me the place from whence the arrows were shot every time the enemy could see a hand. The spot he pointed to as that in which our assailants lay was where a patch of thick growth flourished among some stones, about 50 yards along the rocky pass in the direction in which we had come, and as I was intently watching the place to make out some sign of the enemy, and feeling doubtful whether the black was right, I saw a slight movement and the glint of a flying arrow, which struck the face of the rock a few feet above my head, then fell by Jack Penny's hand. "Mind," I said, as he picked it up, "perhaps it's poisoned." Ti-hi was eagerly watching my face, and as I spoke, he caught the arrow from Jack's hand, placed it against his arm, then closed his eyes and pretended to be dead, but as quickly came to life again as several more arrows struck the rock and fell harmlessly among us. These he gathered together, all but one, whose point was broken by coming in contact with the rock, and that he threw away. After this he carefully strung the bow that he always, like his fellows, carried, and looked eagerly at the doctor, who was scanning the ground in front of us with his little double glass. "I don't like the looks of things, my lads," he said in a low voice, and his countenance was very serious as he spoke. "I intended for ours to be a peaceable mission, but it seems as if we are to be forced into war with two men absent."
"Shall we have to shoot 'em?" said Jack Penny excitedly.
"I hope not," said the doctor, "for I should be sorry to shed the blood of the lowest savage, but we must fight in defense of our lives. We cannot afford to give those up, come what may. Ti-hi fitted an arrow to the string of his short, strong bow, and was about to draw it, but the doctor laid his hand upon him and checked him, to the savage warrior's great disgust. "No," said the doctor, "not until we are obliged, and then I shall try what a charge of small shot will do." We were not long in finding out that it was absolutely necessary to defend ourselves with vigor, for the arrows began to fall thickly. Thickly enough, indeed, to show us that there were more marksmen hidden among the trees than the size of the clump seemed to indicate from where we crouched. I was watching the patch of trees very intently when I heard a sharply drawn inspiration of breath, and turning, I saw the doctor pulling an arrow from the flannel tunic he wore. "As doctors say, Joe," he whispered with a smile, 3 inches more to the right and that would have been fatal." I don't know how I looked, but I felt pale, and winced a little while the doctor took my hand. The force of habit made me snatch it away, for I thought he was going to feel my pulse. I fancied for the moment that it must be to see whether I was nervous, and the blood flushed to my cheeks now and made me look defiant. "Why, Joe, my lad, what is it?" he said quietly. "Won't you shake hands?" "Oh, yes," I cried, placing mine in his, and he gave it a long, firm grip. "I ought," he said after a pause, "to have said more about the troubles, like this one, which I might have known would arise when we arranged to start. But somehow I had a sort of hope that we might make a peaceful journey and not be called upon to shed blood. Joe, my lad, we shall have to fight for our lives." "And shoot down these people," I said huskily. "If we do not, they will shoot us. Poor wretches, they probably do not know the power of our guns. We must give them the small shot first, and we may scare them off. Don't you fire, my lad. Leave it to me." I nodded my head, and then our attention was taken up by the arrows that kept flying in, with such good aim that if we had exposed ourselves in the least, the chances are that we should have been hit. The doctor was on one side of me, Jack Penny on the other, and my tall young friend, I noticed, had been laying some cartridges very methodically close to his hand, ready for action, it seemed to me. But he had not spoken much, only looked very solemn as he lay upon his chest, kicking his legs up and sawing them slowly to and fro. "Are we going to have to fight, Joe Carstairs?" he whispered. "I'm afraid so," I replied. "Oh." That was all for a few minutes, during which time the arrows kept coming in and striking the roof as before, to fall there with a tinkling sound, and be collected carefully by Ti-hi and his companions, all of whom watched us with glowing eyes, waiting apparently for the order to be given when they might reply to the shots of the enemy. "I say, Joe Carstairs," said Jack, giving me a touch with his long arm. "Yes, what is it?" I said peevishly, for his question seemed to be a nuisance. "I don't look horribly frightened, do I?" "No," I said, "you look cool enough. Why?" "Because I feel in a horrid stew, just as I did when a lot of the black fellows carried me off. I was a little one then." "Were you ever a little one, Jack?" I said wonderingly. "Why, of course I was, a very little one. You don't suppose I was born with long legs like a colt, do you? The blacks came one day when father was away, and mother had gone to see after the cow, and after taking all the meal and bacon they went off, one of them tucking me under his arm, and I never made a sound. I was so frightened, for I was sure they were going to eat me. I feel something like I did then. But I say, Joe Carstairs, you're sure I don't show it?" "Sure, yes," I said quickly. "If we have to shoot at these savages, shall you take aim at them?" "All depends," said Jack coolly. "First of all, I shall fire in front of their bows like the man-o'-war's men do. If that don't stop them, I shall fire at their legs. And if that don't do any good, then I shall let them have it right full on, for it'll be their own fault. That's my principle, Joe Carstairs. If a fellow lets me alone, I never interfere with him. But if he begins at me, I'm nasty. Here, "You leave those arrows alone, and, well, what's the matter with you?" This was to Gyp, who was whining uneasily as if he scented danger and wanted to run out. "Down, Gyp, down," said his master, and the dog crouched lower, growling, though, now as a fresh arrow flashed in from another part. The doctor started and raised his gun to take aim at the spot from whence this shot had come, for one of the savages had climbed up and reached a ledge above where we were. In fact, this man's attack made our position 10 times more perilous than it was before. But the doctor did not fire, for Ti-hi, without waiting for orders, drew an arrow to its head, the bowstring gave a loud twang, and the next instant we saw a savage bound from the ledge where he had hidden and run across the intervening space, club in one hand, bow in the other, yelling furiously the while. The doctor was about to fire, and in the excitement of the moment I had my piece to my shoulder, but before he had come halfway the savage turned and staggered back, Ti-hi pointing triumphantly to an arrow sticking deep in the muscles of the man's shoulder. There was a loud yelling as the wounded savage rejoined his companions, and our own men set up a triumphant shout. "That's one to us," said Jack Penny dryly. "I think I shall keep the score." The doctor looked at me just at this time, and I looked back at him, and somehow I seemed to read in his eyes that he thought it would be the best plan to let the blacks fight out the battle with their bows and arrows, and I felt quite happy in my mind for the moment, since it seemed to me that we should get out of the difficulty of having to shed blood. But directly after I coloured with shame, for it seemed cowardly to want to do such work by deputy, and to make these ignorant people fight our battle, while, after all, I was wrong, for the doctor was not thinking anything of the kind. In fact, he knew that we would all have to fight in defense of our lives, and when a flight of about 20 arrows came whizzing and pattering over our heads and hurtled down upon the stony floor, I knew it too, and began to grow cool with the courage of desperation and prepared for the worst.
"Here, Jack Penny," I whispered, "you'll have to fight. The savages mean mischief."
"All right," he replied in a slow, cool, drawling way. "I'm ready for them, but I don't know whether I can hit a man as he runs unless I try to make myself believe he's a kangaroo." The yelling was continued by our enemies, and as far as I could tell it seemed to me there must be at least 30 savages hiding amongst the rocks and trees, and all apparently thirsting for our blood. "It seems hard, doctor," I said bitterly. "They might leave us alone." "I'm afraid they will think that they would have done better in leaving us," said the doctor gloomily, "for I don't mean them to win the day if I can help it." I could not help staring at the doctor. His face looked so stern and strange until, catching my eye, he smiled in his old way and held out his hand. "We shall beat them off, Joe," he said gently. "I would have avoided it if I could, but it has become a work of necessity, and we must fight for our lives. Be careful," he added sternly. "It is no time for trifling. Remember your father, and the mother who is waiting for you at home. Joe, my boy, it is a fight for life, and you must make every shot tell." For the moment I felt chilled with horror, and a sensation of dread seemed to paralyze me. Then came the reaction, and with the thought that if I did not act like a man I should never see those I loved again. This, too, was supplemented, as it were, by that spirit of what the French call camaraderie, that spirit which makes one forget self, and thinking that I had to defend my 2 companions from the enemy, I raised the barrel of my piece upon the low breastwork, ready to fire on the first enemy who should appear. "Look," said Ti-hi just then, for he was picking up scraps of our tongue, and following his pointing finger, I made out the black bodies of several savages creeping to posts of vantage from whence they would be able to shoot. "Take care," said the doctor sternly, as an arrow nearly grazed my ear. "If one of those arrows gives ever so slight a wound, it may prove fatal, my lad. Don't expose yourself in the least." "Ah, the game must begin in earnest," he said, partly under his breath. As he spoke, he took aim at a man who was climbing from rock to rock to gain the spot from which the other had been dislodged. Then there was a puff of white smoke, a roar that reverberated amongst the rocks, and the poor wretch seemed to drop out of sight. The doctor's face looked tight and drawn as he reloaded, and for a moment I felt horrified. But then, seeing a great brawny black fellow raise himself up to draw his bow and shoot at the part where Jack Penny was crouching, and each time seemed to send his arrow more close to my companion, I felt suddenly as if an angry wave were sweeping over my spirit, and lay there scowling at the man. He rose up again, and there was a whiz and a crack that startled me. "I say," drawled Jack Penny, "mind what you're after. You'll hit someone directly." He said this with a strange solemnity of voice, and picking up the arrow he handed it to one of the blacks. "That thing went right through my hair, Joe Carstairs," he continued. "It's making me wild." I hesitated no longer, but as the great savage rose up once more, I took a quick aim and fired just as he was drawing his bow. The smoke obscured my sight for a few moments, during which there was a furious yelling, and then, just as the thin bluish vapor was clearing off, there was another puff and an echoing volley dying off in the distance, for Jack Penny had also fired. "I don't know whether I hit him," he answered, "but he was climbing up there like t'other chap was, and I can't see him now." In the excitement of the fight, the terrible dread of injuring a fellow creature now seemed to have entirely passed away, and I watched one savage stealing from bush to bush and from great stone to stone with an eagerness I could not have believed in till I found an opportunity of firing at him just as he too had reached a dangerous place and had sent his first arrow close to my side. I fired and missed him, and the savage shouted defiance as my bullet struck the stones and raised a puff of dust. The next moment he had replied with a well-directed arrow that made me wince, it was so near my head. By this time I had reloaded and was taking aim again with feverish eagerness, when all at once a great stone crashed down from above and swept the savage from the ledge where he knelt. I looked on appalled as the man rolled headlong down in company with the mass of stone, and then lay motionless in the bottom of the little valley. "Who is it throwing stones?" drawled Jack slowly. "That was a big one, and it hit." "That could not have been an accident," said the doctor. "Perhaps Aroo is up there." "I only hope he is," I cried, "but look, look, what's that?" I caught at the doctor's arm to draw his attention to what seemed to be a great thickly tufted bush which was coming up the little valley toward us. "Birnam Wood is coming to Dunsinane," said the doctor loudly.
"Is it?" said Jack Penny excitedly. "What for? Where? What do you mean?"
"Look, look," I cried, and I pointed to the moving bush. "Well, that's rum," said Jack, rubbing his finger with his nose. "Trees are alive, of course, but they can't walk, can they? I think there's someone shoving that along." "Why, of course there is," I said. "Don't fire unless you're obliged," exclaimed the doctor, "and whatever you do, take care. See how the arrows are coming?" For they were pattering about us thickly, and the blacks on our side kept sending them back, but with what results we could not tell, for the savages kept closely within the cover. It was now drawing toward evening, and the sun seemed hotter than ever. The whole of the sultry ravine seemed to have become an oven, of which our cavern shelter was the furnace. In fact, the heat was momentarily, from the sun's position and in spite of its being so long past the meridian, growing more and more intense. Jack Penny had, of late, grown very silent, but now and then he turned his face toward me with his mouth open, panting with heat and thirst as uneasily as his dog, whose tongue was hanging out, looking white and dry. "Is there any water there?" said the doctor suddenly, as he paused in the act of reloading. "Not a drop," I said dismally. "Oh, don't say that," groaned Jack Penny. "If I don't have some, I shall die." "It will be evening soon," said the doctor in a husky voice, "and this terrible heat will be over. Keep on firing when you have a chance, my lads, but don't waste a shot. We must read them such a lesson that they will draw off and leave us alone." But as he spoke, so far from the loss they had sustained having damped the ardor of the enemy, they kept on sending in the arrows more thickly, but without doing us, thanks to our position and the breastwork, the slightest harm. The sun sank lower, but the rock where we were seemed to grow hotter, the air to be quivering all along the little valley, and as the terrible thirst increased, so did our tortures seem to multiply from the fact that we could hear the heavy, dull, thunderous murmur away to our right, and we knew that it was the cool, clear, delicious water, every drop of which would have given our dried up mouths and parched throats relief. At one time I turned giddy, and the whole scene before me seemed to be spinning round, while my head throbbed with the pain I suffered, my tongue all the time feeling like a piece of dry leather which clung to the roof of my mouth. And still the firing was going steadily on, each sending a bullet straight to its mark whenever opportunity occurred, but apparently without effect, for in the midst of all this firing, and the confusion of shouts from the enemy and defiant replies from our people, the arrows went to and fro as rapidly as ever. If it had not been for the sound of the falling water, I believe I could have borne the thirst far better. But no matter how the fighting went, there was always the soft, deep roar of the plashing water, tantalizing us with thoughts of its refreshing draughts and delicious coolness when laving our fevered heads. I grew so giddy at times that I felt I should only waste my shot if I fired, and refrained, while gaining experience and growing bolder by degrees, the savages aimed so that every shot became dangerous, for they sent them straight at the mass of rock before us some 10 or 12 yards, and this they struck then glanced off, so we were nearly hit 3 times running. Stones were set up at once upon our right as a protection, but this only saved us for a time. The savages had found out the way to touch us, and before many minutes had elapsed, ricochet shots were coming amongst us again. "I can hardly see them, Joe," whispered the doctor suddenly. "My eyes are dizzy with this awful thirst. We must have water if we're to live." He ceased speaking to catch me by the arm and pointed to the bush that had been so long stationary in one place that I had forgotten it. "What's that, my lad?" he whispered. "Is that bush moving, or are my eyes playing me false? It must be on the move. It is some trick. Fire at once and stop it, or we shall be taken in the flank." I raised my gun as I saw the bush moving slowly on towards us, now coming a yard or two, and then stopping, but I was so giddy and confused that I lowered it again, unable to take aim. This took place again and again, and at last I lay there scanning, as in a nightmare, the coming of that great green bush. The doctor was watching with bloodshot eyes the enemy on his own side. Jack Penny was busy on the other, and the command of this treacherous, advancing enemy was left to my gun, which seemed now to have become of enormous weight when I tried to raise it and take aim. "It's all a dream. It's fancy," I said to myself, as I tried to shade my eyes and steady my gaze. But as I said this, the bush once more began to glide on, and the dark patch I saw beneath it must, I felt, be the leg of the savage concealed behind. End of chapter 19. How We Were Besieged, and I Thought of Birnam Wood.
Chapter 20 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Lucy Burgoyne. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 20. How Jimmy Turned Up a Trump. Even then I could not shoot, but remained staring, helplessly fascinated for a few minutes by the coming danger. At last, though, I turned to Ti-hi, leaning back and touching him where he crouched, busily seizing upon the arrows that came in his way and sending them back. He crept up to me directly and pointed to the bush. His eyes glistened, and bending forward he drew an arrow to the head, and was about to send it winging into the very centre of the bush, when we suddenly became aware of some strange excitement amongst the savages, who undoubtedly now caught sight of the bush for the first time, and sent a flight of arrows at it. The effect of this was that he who had been making use of it for a shield suddenly darted from behind it and made for our shelter. "Aroo, aroo!" exclaimed the men with us, yelling with delight, while to cover his escape we all fired at the savages, who had come out of their concealment, but only to dart back again, for one after the other three large stones came bounding down the mountain side, scattering the enemy to cover, and the duel once more began, with our side strengthened by the presence of a brave fighting man, and refreshed, for Aroo had his water calabash slung from his shoulders, containing quite a couple of quarts, which were like nectar to us, parched and half dying with thirst. Its effects were wonderful. The heat was still intense, but after the refreshing draught, small as it was, that we had imbibed, I seemed to see clearly the giddy sensation passed off, and we were ready to meet the attack with something like fortitude. We could think now, too, of some plans for the future, whereas a quarter of an hour before, there had seemed to be no future for us, nothing but a horrible death at our enemy's hands. Ti-hi contrived to make us understand now that as soon as the sun had gone down and it was dark, he would lead us away to the river side and then along the gorge, so that by the next morning we could be far out of our enemy's reach, when they came expecting to find us in the cave. His communication was not easy to comprehend, but that this was what he meant there could be no doubt, for we all three read it in the same way. Encouraged then by this hope, we waited impatiently for the going down of the sun, which was now slowly nearing the broad shoulder of a great hill. Another half hour and it would have disappeared, when the valley would begin to fill with shadows. Darkness, the tropic darkness, would set in at once, and then I knew we should have to lose no time in trying to escape. But we were not to get away without an attack from the enemy of a bolder nature than any they had yet ventured upon. For some little time the arrow shooting had slackened, and we watched anxiously to see what it meant, for there was evidently a good deal of excitement amongst the enemy, who were running from bush to stone, and had we been so disposed, we could easily have brought three or four down. But, of course, all we wished for was freedom from attack, and in the hope that they were somewhat disheartened, and were perhaps meditating retreat, we waited and withheld our fire. Our hopes were short-lived, though, for it proved that they were only preparing for a more fierce onslaught. which was delivered at the end of a few minutes. Some 20 savages bounding along the slope, war club in hand, two to fall disabled by a mass of stone that thundered down from above. We fired at the same moment, and the advance was checked, the savages gathering together in a hesitating fashion, when, crash, crash, another mass of rock, which had been set at liberty far up the hillside, came bounding down, gathering impetuous and setting at liberty an avalanche of great stones, from which the savages now turned and fled for their lives, leaving the valley free to a single black figure, which came climbing down from far up the steep slope, waddy in hand, and on reaching the level advanced towards us in the fast darkening eve, looking coolly to right and left to see if any enemy was left, but without a single arrow being discharged. A minute later, he was looking over our breastwork into the shallow cave, showing his teeth, which shone in the gloom as he exclaimed, "Black fella dreadful hungry. Give Jimmy something eat. All gone now." End of chapter 20. Chapter 21 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Lucy Burgoyne. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 21. How we retreated and were caught in a tropic storm. Our black companion was quite right. The enemy had indeed gone, and the time had come for us to get beyond their reach. For all at once it seemed to grow dark, and we stood farther out of our shelter, glad to free our limbs from the cramping positions in which they had been for so long. The doctor handed to each of us some chips of dried meat, bidding us eat as we walked. The bearers were well provided, and starting at once, with Ti-hi to lead and Aroo to cover our retreat, we stepped lightly off. Our blacks knew well enough what was required of them now as to our baggage, and every package was taken from the breastwork, shouldered or placed upon the head, and, watchful and ready to use our arms, we soon left the scene of the fight behind. The New Guinea savage Ti-hi, as we called him, that being the nearest approach I can get to his name, followed very much the course we had taken early in the day when we sought the waterfall, but left it a little to our left and struck the river some few hundred yards above, pausing for a few minutes for his men to take breath, and then pointing out the course he meant to take. It was a perilous-looking place, enough to make anyone shiver, and there was a murmur amongst the blacks as they looked down at what seemed to be a mere shelf or ledge of rock low down near the black, hurrying water of the river, which seemed to be covered with flowing specks of gold as the brilliant stars were reflected from the smooth, rushing stream. Where we were to descend the water seemed to be about 30 feet below, but the rocky side of the river bed ran sheer up quite 50 feet as far as we could make out in the darkness, and I did not wonder at the murmur we heard. But Ti-hi's voice rose directly, now pleading softly in his own tongue, now in tones of command, and the murmur trailed off into a few mutterings which resulted in the men beginning to descend. They were grumbling about having to go down there, weren't they, Joe Casters, said Jack Penny in a whisper. Yes, I said. And now, to make 'em, he said, I don't like it, even Jip don't like it. Look at him. how he's got his tail between his legs. I say, can't we wait till daylight?" "And be shot by poisoned arrows, Penny," said the doctor quietly. "Come, on with you. I'm sure you're not afraid." "Afraid? What, of walking along there?" said Jack, contemptuously. "Not likely. Was I afraid when I hung over the waterfall?" "Not a bit, my lad. Nor yet when you so bravely helped us to defend ourselves against the savages," said the doctor quietly. "Come along, I'll go first." The blacks were all on ahead, save Aroo and Jimmy, who followed last, I being next to the doctor, and Jack Penny and his dog close behind me. We had to go in single file, for the ledge was not above a yard wide in places, and it was impossible to avoid a shiver of dread as we walked slowly along, assuming a confidence that we did not feel. The path rose and fell slightly in an undulating fashion, but it did not alter much in its width as we journeyed on for what must have been quite a mile, when we had to halt for a few minutes while the bearers readjusted their loads. And a weird party we looked as we stood upon that shelf of rock with the perpendicular side of the gorge towering straight up black towards the sky, the summit showing plainly against the starry arch that spanned the river and seemed to rest upon the other side of the rocky gorge, 50 yards away. And there now, close to our feet, so close that we could have lain down and drunk had we been so disposed, rushed on towards the great fall, the glassy gold speckled water. I was thinking what an awful looking place it was, and wondering whether my father had ever passed this way, when Jack Penny made me jump by giving me a poke with the barrel of his gun. "Don't do that," I said angrily, for I felt that I might have slipped, and to have fallen into that swiftly gliding water meant being borne at headlong speed to the awful plunge down into the basin of foam into which I had looked that day. "Oh, all right," whispered Jack. "I only wanted to tell you that it must be cramp." "What must be cramp?" I replied. "Don't speak so loud, and don't let the doctor hear you," whispered Jack. "I mean, in one of my legs. It will keep waggling so and give way at the knee." "Why, Jack," I said. "No, no," he whispered hastily. "It ain't that. I ain't a bit afraid. It's cramp." "Well, if you are not afraid," I whispered back, "I am. I hope, Jack, I may never live to be in such an awful place again." "I say, Joe Carstairs, say that once more," whispered Jack excitedly. "I hope I may never be—" "No, no, I don't mean that. I mean the other," whispered Jack. "What?" "About being afraid." I said, "Well, I'm not ashamed to own it. It may be cramp, Jack Penny, but I feel as if it is sheer fright." "Then that's what must be the matter with my leg," said Jack eagerly. "Only don't let's tell the doctor." "Ready behind there," said the latter just then. "Yes," I said, "quite ready." And I passed the word to Jimmy and Aroo, who were close to me. "Let's get on then," said the doctor in a low voice. "I want to get out of this awful gorge." "Hooray," whispered Jack Penny, giving me such a dig with his elbow that for the second time he nearly sent me off the rocky shelf. "Hooray, the doctor's frightened too, Joe Carstairs. I ain't ashamed to own it now." "Hist," whispered the doctor then, and slightly raised as was his voice, it seemed strangely loud, and went echoing along the side of the chasm. Going steadily on at once, we found the shelf kept wonderfully the same in width, the only variation being that it dipped down close to the rushing water at times, and then curved up till we were 15 or 20 feet above the stream, with the walls on either side of the river. Though it was different, for they gradually rose higher and higher till there was but a strip of starry sky above our heads, and our path then became so dark that, but for the leading of the sure-footed blacks, we could not have progressed, but must have come to a halt. I was wondering whether this gorge would end by opening out upon some plain, through its being but a gap or pass through a range of hills, but concluded that it would grow deeper and darker, and bring us face to face with a second waterfall. And I whispered to the doctor my opinion, but he did not agree with me. "No," he said, "the gorge is rising, of course, from the way in which the river rushes on, but there can be no waterfall this way, or we should hear it. The noise of the one behind us comes humming along this rocky passage so plainly that we should hear another in the same way. But don't talk, my lad. Look to your footsteps and mind that we have no accident." "Stop," he exclaimed. Then, "Halt." I did not know why he called a halt just then in that narrow, dangerous place, but it seemed that he heard a peculiar sound from behind, and directly after a roo closed up to say that the enemy were following us, for he had heard them talking as they came, the smooth walls of the rocks acting as a great speaking tube and bearing the sounds along. "That's bad news, my lad," said the doctor, "but matters might be worse. This is a dangerous place, but it is likely to be far more dangerous for an attacking party than for the defenders. Our guns could keep any number of enemies at a distance, I should say. Better that they should attack us here than out in the open, where we should be easy marks for their arrows." "I do wish they'd leave us alone," said Jack Penny, in an ill-used tone. "Nobody said anything to them. Why can't they leave off?" "We'll argue out that point another time, Jack Penny," said the doctor. "Only let's get on now." "Oh, all right, I'm ready," he said. And once more our little party set forward, the doctor and I now taking the extreme rear, with the exception that we let Aroo act as a scout behind, to give warning of their enemy's near approach. And so we went on in the comparative darkness, the only sounds heard being the hissing of the swiftly rushing water as it swept on towards the fall, and the dull deep roar that came booming, now loudly, now faintly, from where the river made its plunge. Twice over we made a halt and stood with levelled pieces ready to meet an attack, but they only proved to be false alarms, caused by our friends dislodging stones in the path, which fell with a hollow sullen plunge into the rushing water, producing a strange succession of sounds, as of footsteps beating the path behind us, so curiously were these repeated from the smooth face of the rock. "Hiss, hiss, rush, rush," went the water, and when we paused again and again, so utterly solemn and distinct were the sounds made by the waterfall and the river that I fancied that our friend Aroo must have been deceived. If the savages were pursuing us, I said, we should have heard them by now. "Don't be too satisfied, my dear boy," said the doctor. "These people have a great deal of the animal in them, and when they have marked down their prey, they are not likely to leave the track till the end." I did not like the sound of that word end. It was ominous, but I held my tongue. "As likely as not," continued the doctor, "the enemy are creeping cautiously along within a couple of hundred yards of where we stand, and..." "I say," cried Jack Penny eagerly, "it's rather cold standing about here. Hadn't we better make haste on?" "Decidedly, Penny," said the doctor. "Forward." "Yes, let's get forward," I said, and the doctor suddenly clapped his hand over my mouth and whispered, "Hush, look there." "I can't see anything," I said, after a long gaze in the direction by which we had come. "Can you see just dimly, close to where that big star makes the blur in the water, a light-coloured stone?" "Yes, watch it for a minute." I fixed my eyes upon the dimly seen rock, just where quite a blaze of stars flecked the black water with their reflections, but for a time I saw nothing. I only made my eyes ache, and a strong desire came upon me to blink them very rapidly. Then all at once the stone seemed darker for a moment, and then darker again, as if a cloud had come between the glinting stars and the earth. It was so plain that a couple of the savages had glided by that stone that we felt it would be best to remain where we were for the present, awaiting for the attack that we knew must follow. "We are prepared now," whispered the doctor, "and if we must fight, it would be better to fight now than have to turn suddenly and meet an attack on our rear." The result was that we remained watching through the next painful hour, guns and bows ready for the first oncoming of the savages. But with terrible distinctness, there was the washing sound of the river hissing past the rocks, and the rising and falling musical roar of the distant cascade, nothing more. Then another hour of silence in that awful chasm passed away, with the expectation of being attacked every moment, keeping our nerves upon the stretch. How different it all seemed! What a change from the peaceful life at home! There I had led a happy boyish life, with the black for my companion. Sometimes he would disappear to live amongst his tribe for a few weeks, but he always returned, and just after breakfast there would be his merry black face, eagerly watching for my coming to go with him to catch fish in some fresh creek or waterhole that he had discovered, to hunt out wallabies or some other of the hopping kangaroo family peculiar to the land. Jimmy had always some fresh expedition on the way, upon which we started with boy-like eagerness. But now, all at once, consequent upon my determination, my course of life had been changed, and it seemed that, young as I was, all the work that fell to my hand was man's work. Yesterday I was a boy, now I was a man. That was my rather conceited way of looking upon matters then, and there was some ground for my assumption of manliness. But if excuses be needed, let me say in my defence that I was suddenly cast into this career of dangerous adventure, and I was very young. Such some musings as the above, mixed up with recollections of my peaceful bedroom at home, and the gentle face that bent over me to kiss me when I was half asleep, were busy in my brain, when the doctor said softly, "This seems to be such a strong place, Joe, my lad, that I hardly like leaving it. But we must get on. Go forward and start them. Tell them to be as quiet as possible." His words seemed full of relief, and I started round to obey him, glad to have an end to the terrible inaction, when, to my utter astonishment, I found Jack Penny, who was behind me, sitting with his legs dangling over the edge of the rocky shelf, and apparently within an inch or two of the water, while his shoulders were propped against the side of the chasm. His rifle was in his lap, and his chin buried in his breast, fast asleep. "Jack," I whispered softly, utterly astounded that anyone could sleep at a time like that. But he did not hear me. "Jack," I said again, and laid my hand upon his shoulder, but without result. "Jack," I said, giving him an impatient shove. "Get out," he mumbled softly, and Jip, whom I had not seen before, resented this interference with his master by uttering a low growl. "Down, Jip," I said. "Here, Jack, wake up," I whispered, and this time I gave him a kick in the leg. "I'll give you such a one-er if you don't be quiet," he growled. "Let me alone, will you?" "Jack, be quiet," I whispered, with my lips to his ear. "The savages are close at hand." "Who cares for the savages?" he grumbled, yawning fearfully. "Oh, I am so sleepy. I say, I wish you'd be quiet." "Wake up," I said, shaking him, and Jip growled again. "Shan't," very decidedly. "Wake up directly, Jack. Jack Penny, wake up." "Shan't, get out." "Hist," whispered the doctor from behind me. "Wake up," I said again, going down on one knee so that I could whisper to him. "Snore." It was a very decided one, and when I laid my gun down and gave a tug at him, it was like pulling at something long and limp, say a big bolster that gave way everywhere, till in my impatience I doubled my fist and, quite in a rage, gave him, as his head fell back, a smart rap on the nose. I had previously held him by the ears and tapped the back of his head against the rock without the slightest effect, but this tap on the nose was electric in its way, for Jack sprung up, letting his gun fall, threw himself into a fighting attitude and struck out at me. But he missed me, for when his gun fell, it would have glided over the edge of the rocky shelf into the stream, if I had not suddenly stooped down and caught it, the result being that Jack's fierce blow went right over my head, while when I rose upright, he was wide awake. "I say," he said coolly, "have I been asleep?" "Asleep, yes," I whispered hastily. "Here, come along. We are to get forward. How could you sleep?" "Oh, I don't know," he said. "Only just closed my eyes. Why, here's somebody else asleep." Sure enough, Jimmy was curled up close to the rock, with his hands tucked under his arms, his waddy in one fist, a hatchet in the other. Jack Penny was in so sour a temper at having been awakened from sleep, and in so rude a way, that he swung one of his long legs back, and then sent it forward. "Don't kick him," I said hastily, but I was too late, for the black received the blow from Jack's foot right in the ribs, and starting up with his teeth grinding together, he struck a tremendous blow with his waddy, fortunately at the rock, which sent forth such an echoing report through the gully that the doctor came hurriedly to our side. "What is it?" he said in an anxious whisper. "Big bunyip hit Jimmy rib." "Kick bangum, bangum," cried the black furiously. "Who kick black fellow? Bash him head, Yeah. He finished his rapidly uttered address by striking a warlike attitude. "It's all right now," I whispered to the doctor. "Come along, Jimmy." And taking the black's arm, I pushed him on before me, growling like an angry dog. "All right," the doctor said. "Yes, for our pursuers. Get on as quickly as you can." I hurried on now to the front, giving Ti-hi his order to proceed, and then signing to the bearers to go on. I was getting back past them along the narrow path, and had just got by Jimmy and reached Jack Penny, when there was a flash and a rattling echoing report as of 20 rifles from where the doctor was keeping guard. I knew that the danger must be imminent, or he would not have fired, and passing Jack Penny, who was standing ready, rifle in hand, I reached the doctor just as there was another flash and roar echoing along the gully. "That's right, my lad," he whispered. "Be ready to fire if you see them coming while I reload." I knelt down, resting my elbow on my knee, and found it hard work to keep the piece steady as I waited to see if the savages were coming on. I had not long to wait before I distinctly saw a couple of dimly seen figures against the surface of the starlit water. I fired directly, and then again, rising afterwards to my feet to reload. "Now back as you load, quickly," whispered the doctor, and he caught Aroo by the shoulder and drew him back as half a dozen arrows came pattering against the rock over our head and fell at our feet. "Back," whispered the doctor quietly. "We must keep up a running fight." "Here, hold hard a minute," said Jack Penny aloud. "I must have a shot at him first." "No, wait," cried the doctor. "Your turn will come." Jack Penny uttered a low growl in his deep bass voice, which was answered by Jip, who was getting much excited, and had to be patted and restrained by angry orders to lie down before he would consent to follow his master in the hurried retreat we made to where Ti-ha and his men were waiting for us. Here we found the shelf had widened somewhat, and some pieces of rock that had fallen offered shelter from an attack. As we joined them, the men, who had laid down their loads, prepared to discharge a volley of arrows, but they were stopped, as it would have been so much waste. For the next 6 hours, till the stars began to pale, ours was one continuous retreat before the enemy, who seemed to grow bolder each time we gave way and hurried along the edge of the river to a fresh halting place. We fired very seldom, for it was only waste of ammunition, and the darkness was so great that though they often sent a volley of arrows amongst us, not one of our party was hurt. It was a fevered and exciting time, but fortunately we were not called upon to suffer as we had during the attack upon the cave. Then we were maddened almost by the heat and thirst. Now we had ample draughts of cool, refreshing water to fly to from time to time, or to bathe our temples where the shelf was low. The savages made no attempts at concealing their presence now, and we could hear a loud buzz of excited voices constantly in our rear, but still they did not pursue us right home, but made rushes that kept us in a constant state of excitement and, I may say, dread. "Do you think they will get tired of this soon, doctor?" I said, just at daybreak, when I found the doctor looking at me in a strange and haggard way. "I can't say, my lad," he whispered back. "We must hope for the best." Just then Ti-hi came from the front to sign to us to hurry on, and following him we found that he had hit upon a place where there was some hope of our being able to hold our own for a time. It was extremely fortunate, for the coming day would make us an easy mark, the pale grey light that was stealing down having resulted in several arrows coming dangerously near. and though there were equal advantages for us in the bodies of our enemies becoming easier to see, we were not eager to destroy life, our object, as I have before said, being to escape. We followed Ti hi to find that the narrow shelf slowly rose now higher and higher, till at the end of a couple of hundred yards it gained its highest point of some 25 feet above the river, while to add to the advantage of our position, the rock above the path stretched over it like the commencement of some Titan's arch that had been intended to bridge the stream, one that had either never been finished or had crumbled and fallen away. In support of this last fanciful idea, there were plenty of loose rocks and splinters of stones that had fallen from above, mingled with others whose rounded shapes showed that they must have been ground together by the action of water. I did not think of that at the time, though I had good reason to understand it later on. The position was admirable, the ledge widening out considerably. We were safe from dropping arrows, and we had only to construct a strong breastwork, some 5 feet long, to protect us from attack by the enemy. In fact, in 5 minutes or so, we were comparatively safe. In 10 minutes or a quarter of an hour, our breastwork was so strengthened that we began to breathe freely. By this time it was morning, but instead of its continuing to grow light down in the ravine, whose walls towered up on either side, the gathering light seemed suddenly to begin to fade away. It grew more obscure. The soft, cool, refreshing morning breeze died away, to give place to a curious sultry heat. The silence, save the rushing of the river, was profound, and it seemed at last as if it was to be totally dark. "What does this mean, Doctor?" I said, as I glanced round and noted that the sombre reflection from the walls of the chasm gave the faces of my companions a ghastly and peculiar look. "A storm, my lad," he said quietly. "Look how discoloured the water seems. There has been a storm somewhere up in the mountains, I suppose, and now it is coming here." "Well, we are in shelter," I said, "and better off than our enemies." "What difference does that make?" grumbled Jack Penny, in ill-used tones. "They can't get wet through, for they don't wear hardly any clothes. But, I say, ain't it time we had our breakfast? I've given up my night's rest, but I must have something to eat." "Quick, look out, my lads, look out," cried the doctor, as there was a loud yelling noise from the savages, whom we could plainly see now coming along the narrow path, while almost simultaneously there was a vivid flash of lightning that seemed to blind us for the time, and then a deafening roar of thunder, followed so closely by others that it was like one rolling, incessant peal. End of chapter 21.
Chapter 22 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by John Hartley. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 22. How High the Water Came. The coming of the storm checked the furious onslaught of our black enemies, but it was only for the moment, setting thunder, lightning, and the deluge rain at defiance. They came rushing on, shouting and yelling furiously, and we were about to draw trigger, reluctantly enough, but in sheer desperation, when a volley of arrows checked them for a time, while resuming what seemed to be a favourite means of warring upon his enemies, Jimmy commenced hurling masses of stone at the coming foes. Checked as they were, though, it was only for a while, we were compelled to fire again and again, with fresh assailants taking the place of those who fell. The thunder pealed so that the reports of our pieces seemed feeble, more like the crack of a cart whip, and their flashes were as sparks compared with the blinding lightning, which darted and quivered in the gorge, at times seeming to lick the walls, at others plunging into the rushing, seething stream, into which the rain poured in very cataracts down the rocky sides. We should have ceased in very awe of the terrible battle of the elements, but in self-defence we were driven to fight hard and repel the continued attack of the enemy, who, growing more enraged at our resistance, came on once more in a determined fashion, as if meaning this time to sweep us before them into the rushing stream. But for the bravery of our black companions, our efforts would have been useless, and we should certainly have been driven back by the fierce savages who advanced up the path, sprang upon the stone breastwork, and would have dashed down us regardless of our firearms. But Taihai and Aru cast aside their bows at this final onslaught, and used their war clubs in the most gallant manner. Jimmy, too, seemed to be transformed into as brave a black warrior as ever fought, and it was the gallant resistance offered that checked the enemy and made them recoil. The falling back of the foremost men, who were beaten and stunned by the blows they had received, drove their companions to make a temporary retreat and enable us to reload. But ere we could seem to get breath, one who appeared to be the chief rallied them, and two abreast, all that the path would allow, they came charging up towards us once again. Then there was a dead pause as the thunder crashed overhead once more, and then seemed to be continued in a strange rushing sound, which apparently paralysed the attacking party, who hesitated, stopped short about a third of the way up the narrow slope that led to our little fort, and then, with a shriek of dismay, turned and began to retreat. I stared after them, wondering that they should give way just at a time when a bold attack would probably have ended in our destruction. But I could make out nothing, only that the noise of the thunder still seemed to continue and grow into a sound like a fierce rush. But this was nothing new. The thunder had been going on before, and that and the blinding lightning the enemy had braved. Our defence had had no effect upon them, save to make them attack more fiercely, and yet they were now in full retreat, falling over each other in their haste, and we saw two thrust into the swift river. "Ayah, big bunyip, water, water," roared Jimmy just then, clapping me on the shoulder, and turning sharply, I saw the meaning of the prolongation of the thunder. For a great wave, at least 10 feet high, ruddy, foaming, and full of tossing branches, came rushing down the gorge, as if in chase of our enemies. And before I had more than time to realise the danger, the water had leapt by us, swelling to almost to our place of refuge, and where, a minute before, there had been a rocky shelf, the path along which we had come, there was now the furious torrent tearing along at racing speed. I turned aghast to the doctor, and then made as if to run, expecting that the next moment we should be swept away, but he caught me by the arm with a grip like iron. "Stand still," he roared, with his lips to my ear. "The storm, high up in the mountains, flood, the gorge." Just then there was another crashing peal of thunder, close upon a flash of lightning, and the hissing rain that ceased as if by magic, while the sky began to grow lighter. The dull boom of the tremendous wave had passed too, but the river hissed and roared as it tore along beneath our feet, and it was plain to see that it was rising higher still. The noise was not so great, though, now, that we could not talk, and after recovering from the appalling shock of the new danger, we had time to look around. Our first thought was of our enemies, and we gazed excitingly down the gorge, and then at each other. Jack Penny shuddering and turning away his head, while I felt the cold chill of horror as I fully realised the fact that they had been completely swept away. There could not be a moment's doubt of that, for the wave spread from rocky wall to rocky wall and dashed along at frightful speed. We had only escaped a similar fate through being on the summit, so to speak, of the rocky path. But though for the moment safe, we could not tell for how long, while on taking a hasty glance at our position, it was this. Overhead, the shelving rock quite impassable. To left, to right, and in front, the swollen, rushing torrent. The doctor stood looking down at the water for a few moments, and then turned to me. How high above the surface of the water were we, do you think, when we came here? I should say about 25 feet. Why, we ain't 4 foot above it now. And look there. It's rising fast. I say, Joe Carstairs, if I'd known we were going to be drowned, I wouldn't have come. Are you sure it is rising? Said the doctor, bending down to examine the level, an example I followed. To see crack and crevice gradually fill and point after point covered by the seething water, which crept up slowly and insidiously higher and higher, even as we watched. Yes, said the doctor, rising to his feet and gazing calmly round, as if to see whether there was any loophole left for escape. Yes, the water is rising fast. There can be no doubt of that. Just then Jip, who had been fierce and angry, snapping and barking furiously at the savages each time they charged, suddenly threw up his head and uttered a dismal howl. "Here, you hold your noise," cried Jack Penny. "You don't hear us holler, do you? Lie down." The dog howled softly and crouched at his master's feet, while Jack began to take off his clothes in a very slow and leisurely way. First he pulled off his boots, then his stockings, which he tucked methodically, along with his garters, inside his boots. This done, he took off his jacket, folded it carefully, and his shirt followed, to be smoothed and folded and laid upon the jacket. And now, for the first time, I thoroughly realised how excessively thin poor Jack Penny was, and the reason why he had so often had a pain in his back. It seemed a strange time, after passing through such a series of dangers, after escaping by so little from being swept away, and while in terrible danger from the swiftly rising waters. But I could not help it. Jack's aspect, as he sat there coolly, very coolly, clothed in his trousers alone, was so ludicrous that I burst out laughing, when Jimmy joined in and began to dance with delight. "What are you laughing at?" said Jack, half vexed with mirth. "At you," I said. "Why, what are you going to do?" "Do," he said. "Why, swim for it. You don't suppose I'm going to try it in my clothes?" My mirth died out as swiftly as it came, for the doctor laid his hand upon my arm and pressed it silently to call my attention to our black followers, who were laying their bows and arrows regularly in company with their waddies, each man looking very stern and grave. They showed no fear, they raised no wild cry, they only seemed to be preparing for what was inevitable. And as I saw Ti-hi bend over and touch the water easily with his hand, and then rise up and look round at his companions, saying a few words in their tongue. The chill of horror came back once more, for I knew that the group of savages felt their time had come, and that they were sitting there patiently waiting for the end. Chapter 23 of Bunyip Land. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by John Hartley. Bunyip Land by George Manville Fenn. Chapter 23. We Await Our Fate. I glanced from the blacks to the doctor to see that he was intently gazing up the gorge where the rushing water came seething down, and I read in his face that he could not see the slightest hope. I looked at Jack Penny, who was deeply intent on a little blue anchor that some bush shepherd had tattooed on his thin white arm. Then I turned to Jimmy, whose quick dark eyes were busy inspecting his toes, on the right foot having hold of his war club, which he was holding out for Gyp to smell. He alone of the party did not seem to realise the fact that the end was so near. "Can we do anything, Doctor?" I said at last in a low, awe-stricken voice. He gazed at me tenderly and held out his hand, pressed mine when I laid it in his grasp. "No, my lad," he said, "nothing. I've tried mentally to see a way out of our peril, but I can see none. Unless the water sinks, we are lost. Joe, my lad, you must act like a man." "I'll try, Doctor," I said in a choking voice. And as I spoke, once more there seemed to rise up before me our quiet, peaceful home near Sydney, with its veranda and flowers and the simply furnished pretty rooms, in one of which sat my mother, waiting for tidings of her husband and son. I could not help it, but I clasped my hands together, uttering a despairing cry, for it seemed so hard to give up hope, when so young and full of health and strength. Even if it had been in the midst of the roar and turmoil of the storm, it would not have seemed so bad, or when the great flood wave came down. But now, in these calm, cool moments, when there was nothing to excite, nothing to stir the blood, and, above all, just when the sky was a dazzling blue, with a few silvery clouds floating away in the rear of the storm, while the sun shone down gloriously, it seemed too hard to bear. I gazed eagerly at the water to see it was nearly a foot higher, and then I joined the doctor in searching the rock with my eyes for a place that we might find a foothold and clamber beyond the reach of the rushing torrent. But no, there seemed to be no spot where even a bird could climb, and in despair I too began to strip off some of my clothes. "Are you going to try to swim?" said the doctor gravely. I nodded. "That's right," he said. "I shall do the same. We might reach some ledge lower down." He said that word might with a slow and solemn emphasis that made me shudder, for I knew he felt that it was hopeless. But all the same, he granted that it was our duty to try. The doctor now bent down over the water, and I could see that it was rising faster than ever. All at once, Jimmy seemed to rouse himself, throwing up his waddy with his foot and catching it in his hand. "No water go down," he said. Mass Joe, doctor, and all get up higher. No get wet. Top along, get drown, die, and Bunyip pull 'em down and eat 'em." "I'm afraid escape is impossible, Jimmy," I said sadly. "No, no, what 'em say," cried the black impatiently. "Can't get away," I said. "No get away. Wait 'em, wait 'em. Jimmy, Jimmy, see." He went to the edge of the shelf and dipped one foot in the water, then the other, working his toes about, and then, after a contemptuous look at the blacks, who were calmly awaiting their fate, he looked up at the face of the rock beyond, curving over an abutment, and, reaching up as high as he could, began to climb. It did not seem to occur to him, at first, that if he were able to escape, no one else would be, and he tried twice, with a wonderful display of activity, which resulted merely in his slipping back. Then he tried elsewhere in two places, but with the same result, and after a few more trials, he came to me and stood rubbing the back of his head, as if puzzled at being so helpless and beaten at every turn. "Get much, too much water, Mass Joe," he said. "What am I going to do?" I shook my head sadly, and we went to the doctor, who was watching the progress of the rushing river as it rose inch by inch. Cracks and points of rock that we had before noticed disappearing entirely, till the flowing earth-stained surface was but a few inches below the ledge where we're grouped, waiting for the time when we should be swept away. In spite of the knowledge that at most in an hour the ledge would be covered, I could not help watching the rushing stream as it dashed along. It was plain enough to me now why the sides of the gorge were so smooth and regular, for the action of the water must have been going on like this for many ages after every storm, and, laden as the waters were with masses of wood and stone, pebbles and sand, the scouring of the rocks must have been incessant. Then my thoughts came back to our horrible position, and I looked around in despair, but only to be ashamed out of any frantic display of grief by the stoical calmness with which all seemed to be preparing to meet their fate. Still the water rose steadily, higher and higher, inch by inch, and I could see that in a few minutes it would be over the ledge. I was noting, too, that now it was so near the end, my companions seemed adverse to speaking to me or each other, but were evidently moody and thoughtful. All but Jimmy, who seemed to be getting excited, and yet not much alarmed. I had gone to the extreme edge of the ledge, where the water nearly lapped my feet, and gazing straight up the gorge at the sunlit waters, kept backing slowly up the slope, driven away as the river rose, when the black came to me and touched my shoulder. "Poor black fellow there, going to die, Master Joe. Not die yet, while Jimmy not go die, till funum father. Lot of time, Jimmy, not ready to die, lot of time. But how are we to get away, Jimmy? How are we to escape?" "Black fellow have big think," he replied. "Much big think, and find em way. Great tupperd go die. And quite well, thank you, Master Joe. Jimmy black fellow won't die yet. Master Joe have big swim. Long o Jimmy, swim much fuss all down the water. Won't die, oh no, oh no." There was so much hope and confidence in the black's manner and his broken English that I felt my heart give a great throb, but the sight of the calm resignation of my companions dampened me again, till Jimmy once more spoke. "Mass Joe, take off closum. Put long gun up in corner. Come and fetch em when no water. Big swim." Many had been the times when Jimmy and I had dashed into the river and swum about by the hour together. Why not then now try to save our lives in spite of the roughness of the torrent and the horrors of the great fall I knew? Two, that the fall must be at least 2 to 3 miles away, and there was always the possibility of getting into some eddy and struggling out. My spirits rose then at these thoughts, and I rapidly threw off part of my clothes, placing my gun and hatchet with the big knife all tied together in a niche of the rock where their weight and the shelter might save them from being washed away. As I did this, I saw the doctor look up sadly, but only to lower his head again till his chin rested upon his chest, while Jack Penny stared and drew his knees up to his chin, embracing his legs and nodding his head sagely, as if he quite approved of what I was doing. The only individual who made any active demonstration was who jumped up and came to me wagging his tail and uttering a sharp bark or two. Then he ran off to the water, snuffed at it, lapped a little, and threw up his head again, barking and splashing in it a little as he ran in breast high and came back, as if imitating that he was ready at any moment for a swim. The doctor looked up now, and a change seemed to have come over him, for he rose from where he had been seated and took my hand. "Quite right, my lad," he said. "One must never say despair. There is a ledge there higher up where we will place the ammunition. Let's keep that dry if we can. It may not be touched by the water. Even if we have to swim for our lives, the guns won't hurt. That is, if they're not washed away." It was as if he had prepared himself for the worst, and was now going to make strenuous efforts to save himself and his friends, after we'd taken such precautions as we could about our stores. Jimmy grinned and helped readily to place the various articles likely to be damaged by water as high as we could on ledges and blocks of stone. Though I did all this, it was with a feeling that we were never likely to see the things again. Still, it was like doing one's duty, and I felt that then, of all times, was the hour for that. So we worked on, with many a furtive glance at the water, which kept on encroaching till it began to lap the feet of our black companions. But they did not stir. They remained with their positions unaltered, and still the water advanced, till the highest point of the ledge was covered, and Gyp began whining and paddling about, asking us, as it were, with his intelligent eyes, whether we did not mean to start. "Hi, Gyp, Gyp," shouted Jimmy just then. "Up along, boy, up along." And he patted the top of one of the stones that we had used for a breastwork. The dog leaped up directly, placing himself 3 feet above the flood, and stood barking loudly. "Yes, we can stand up there for a while," said the doctor, "and that will prolong the struggle a bit. Here, come up higher," he cried, making signs to our black companions, who after a time came unwillingly from their low position, splashing mournfully through the water, but evidently unwilling even then to disobey their white leader. They grouped themselves with us close up to the breastwork, where we stood with the water rising still higher, and then all at once I felt we must swim for a fresh wave, the result probably of some portion of the flood that had been dammed up higher on the river course, swept right up to our lips. But for the strength of our stone breastwork, we must have been borne away. As it was, we were standing by it, some on either side, and all clinging together. We withstood the heavy wrench that the water seemed to give, and held on, the only one who lost his footing being Jack Penny, who was dragged back by the doctor as the wave passed on. "Enough to pull your arms out of the socket," whined Jack dolefully. "I say, please don't do it again." Higher and higher came the water, icily cold and numbing. The way of the past was succeeded by another, but that only reached our waist. And when it had gone by, there was the old slow rising of the flood as before, till it was as high as our knees. Then, by degrees, it crept on and on, till I was standing with it reaching my hips. A fearful silence now ensued, and the thought came upon me that when the final struggle was at hand, we should be so clasped together that swimming would be impossible, and we must all be drowned. And now, once more, with the water rising steadily, the old stunned, helpless feeling began to creep over me, and I began to think of home in a dull, heavy manner, of the happy days when I had hardly a care, and perhaps a few regrets were mixed in with it all. But somehow I did not feel as if I repented of coming, save when I thought that my mother would have two sorrows now when she came to know of her loss. Then everything seemed to be numbed. My limbs began to feel helpless, and my thoughts moved sluggishly, and in a half-dreamy fashion I stood there pressed against the rock, holding tightly by the doctor on one side, by Jimmy on the other, and in another minute I knew that the rising water would be at my lips. I remember giving a curious gasp, as if my breath was going, and in imagination I recalled my sensations when, during a bathing expedition, I went down twice before Jimmy swam to my help and held me up. The water had not touched my lips. It was only at my chest, but I fancied I felt bubbling in my nostrils and strangling me. I seemed to hear it thundering in my ears. There was the old pain at the back of my neck, and I struggled to get my hands free to beat the water like a drowning dog. But they were held tightly by my companions. How tightly, probably, they never knew. Then I remembered that my head suddenly seemed to grow clear, and I was repeating to myself the words of familiar old prayer when my eyes fell upon the surface of the water. I felt as if I could not breathe. The next minute Gyp was barking furiously as he stood upon his hind legs, resting his paws upon his master's shoulders. And Jimmy gave a loud shout. "All the water, run away, just fast now." And as he spoke, it fell a couple of inches, a couple more, so swiftly indeed, that the terrible pressure that held us tightly against the stones was taken off pound by pound, and before we could realize the truth, the water was at my knees. 10 minutes later, it was at my feet, and before half an hour had passed, we were standing in glorious sunshine with the rock ledge drying fast, while the river, minute by minute, was going down, so that we felt sure, if no storm came to renew the flood, it would be at its old level in a couple of hours. We were dripping and numb by the icy water, but in that fierce sunshine it was wonderful how soon our wrung-out garments dried, and warmth was rapidly restored to our limbs by rocks that soon grew heated in the torrid rays. "Big Bunyip got no more water. All gone dis time," said Jimmy calmly. "Poor black fellows tink go die. No die, Jimmy. Lots of do find 'em fader all over big country. Water all gone. Jimmy cunning, artful. Not mean and die dis time. Bunyip not got enough water. Give Jimmy something eat. Ready eat half sheep and damper. Give Jimmy some eat." We all wanted something to eat, and eagerly we set to work. But soaking damper was not very sumptuous repast. Still, we feasted as eagerly as if it had been the most delicious food. And all the time, the water kept going down. End of chapter 23.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.